It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. So good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to the 85th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. My most recent column, The West of the Guardian, is online at website www.westchesterguardian.com. This is the 159th column in the Creative Disruption series. So I hope you'll read the column, enjoy them, and if the need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows in this series and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Try the newspaper and subscribe, only one email per day. And you can see that at www.johnmack13.com. The list of upcoming shows is also at the site. My guest next week is editor, columnist, and owner of the mysterious bookshop in New York City, Otto Penzium. I hope you'll join us then. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is wealth management advisor, columnist, blogger, and author Norm Vonnegut. His website, which includes his blog, ACRIMONY, and then also the link to the trust site that you might follow, is located at http://norbvonnegut.com. That's NORBVONNEGUT, norbvonnegut.com. Good evening, Norb, and welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, John.
Right from the start, to eliminate any confusion, that's the famous last name for the writer. What is the relationship, if any?
Well, Kurt was my fourth cousin. All Vonneguts are related, and so if you run into somebody with my last name, say hi for me.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. Where exactly did you grow up, then go to early school?
Grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, which I absolutely loved. Charleston's a beautiful city. And my dad was in the Air Force for 27 years, and so I was an Air Force brat. And his last post was at the Charleston Air Force Base in South Carolina. And once he retired, we just stayed. But I'll just give my dad a plug. He's deceased, but he was in World War II, the Korean War, and finally in Vietnam. He was a pilot in all three. And out of Charleston, South Carolina, that's where he flew missions to Vietnam.
Wow. See, I agree about Charleston. My wife Barbara and I had the place in Hilton Head for about 10 years, and Barbara spent some time in Charleston at an educational conference at the College of Charleston, and she really liked it. And I understand that the devastation that could have happened with one of the hurricanes did not hit Charleston as badly as they expected about 10 years ago, I guess.
Are you talking about Hugo, John?
Am I talking about what?
About Hurricane Hugo? I was in Charleston during Hurricane Hugo, and I'll tell you, that was just awful. We were without power for 5 days, and my neighbor's roof ended up in our backyard. And in fact, we were really concerned. I mean, Charleston isn't that high above sea level. And so we didn't know what would happen in terms of the tide and how much of the town it would flood. And it was pretty bad. I mean, there was a lot of damage. But this dates back a long time ago. We were in Charleston after my wife and I graduated from business school from 1986 to 1993. So that gives you a sense.
That would have been it. They expected it to devastate Hilton Head. Then we weren't in a place at the time. But it didn't hit Hilton Head at all. We had no damage. But I thought there was concern that it would wipe out many of the historical landmarks in Charleston, and it wasn't as bad as they had projected. I could be wrong, but...
No, I mean, the city survived, and it survived. That's what I can say. And in fact, there was so much insurance money that flooded into Charleston after Hurricane Hugo hit that it experienced a mini boom because everybody was renovating their homes and painting and putting on new roofs. And at that time, when the United States was in sort of a recession, Hugo brought a lot of money to the area. And so there was a mini boom. But, you know, what I will say about Charleston is that so much of the good things that have occurred in that town are a function of Mayor Joe Riley. I don't know how long he was the mayor. I think this is his last year, but he was there as mayor for either 30 or 40 years. And his unflagging commitment to the city is why it is what it is today. I mean, he's just done everything right. Renovation, bringing business there. And he saw us through the hurricane back in, I think it was the early 90s when Hugo hit. I just don't recall.
Right. I know that we still had the place there, so it was either the 80s or the early 90s. What were your earliest aspirations growing up there? Did you want to be a writer? Or?
No, you want to hear something funny? So I grew up in a household that was intensely Catholic, and I don't remember exactly when it was, but my earliest aspiration is I wanted to be the Pope. That's what I wanted to do.
That didn't work out, though, huh?
No, it didn't work out. And I'll tell you what, the guy in the job right now is a lot better than I ever would have been. It's funny how life changes. I want to be the Pope, and I want to be an astronaut. And then I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to go to Notre Dame, and none of those things happened. I ended up going into business. I didn't go to Notre Dame. I went to Harvard College in the late 70s, I guess it was. And I ended up working on Wall Street for, 20 years, 16 in wealth management.
Now you didn't go to high school in South Carolina, though. Where'd you go to high school?
Well, I went to high school in Charleston for 2 years. I went to a great place called Bishop England. And in recent months, I should say, have had the great pleasure of reconnecting with a lot of my friends just by happenstance. But I was at Bishop England for 2 years, and I ended up going to Phillips Exeter in Exeter, New Hampshire. And it wasn't the kind of thing that was part of my family, if you will. It wasn't part of our experience. When I first heard about Exeter, I thought it was a college. I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand the concept of a boarding school. And when the nuns at Bishop England talked to me about Exeter, I said, come on, I'm going to Notre Dame. What's this Exeter thing? And I went to some interviews, and I just loved what I saw, and I learned more about what a boarding school is all about. And I had two fabulous years in Exeter, New Hampshire, and I graduated from college at Phillips Exeter.
So what did it? What brought that on? The transfer from South Carolina to boarding school in New Hampshire. Was there any specific reason, or?
Yeah, I mean. I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything. Grades. I had good grades.
Oh, okay.
And that's what brought me to Exeter. But, you know, it was a boarding school. And so I went up there, and I came home three times during the course of the year, and or maybe twice, you know. And I just had a great experience. It was a fun place to go to school.
You mentioned Harvard. What did you major in there? And
U.S. history with a minor in Asian studies. And I had four really wonderful years there. In fact, I have in the last 3 years that I was there, I roomed with eight other guys. And these guys are my closest friends in life. And it's funny how that happens. I mean, we just bonded. And so we get together about once a year. And when we get together, we're just like we were as undergraduates again. And we stay in touch, and they're just good friends. And so the Harvard experience for me was frankly more about the friendships that I developed than necessarily the studies. Although you know, the courses were great and I loved what I studied.
Yeah, it's interesting that bonding, that young bonding. I'm close to people from my old neighborhood in New York City, and when we get together, even if we haven't seen each other for 15 years, there's never any one-upsmanship, but there's never anything like that. It just seems very natural. You just slide back into the relationship, and it's something that you don't read about or you don't hear about. But when you talk to people who have similar experiences, they understand what you're talking about.
I totally get it.
You, of course, write for publication and you blog now. Did you write in college?
Not as part of a paper, not as part of newspaper or anything like that. I mean, of course, we had papers for our classes, and I wrote those. But, you know, probably one of the best courses that I had in college, my senior year, and it was an unusual course for me. It was taught by Alan Trussman, who wrote Bullitt and the Thomas Crown Affair, the original screenplays. And he was absolutely a fabulous teacher, great storyteller. He came to the campus, I think, only for one semester. And in that class, we wrote screenplays. And the idea was, at the end of the semester, if the screenplays were good enough, he would try to take them to Hollywood and get them produced. And, you know, it was just a lot of fun. I completed a screenplay. It was absolutely dreadful. But, you know, that I didn't, that wasn't really the point. The point was, just in being around him, listening to his stories about Hollywood, and also understanding how to think about films and characters. That was a lot of fun. And that course, as I recall, was the only creative writing that I did in college, because I really focused on my Asian studies and American history studies at the time. And during my senior year as well, I had I wrote a thesis on the Hukbalahap Rebellion in the Philippines. And so that was my focus, not the creative writing, but I must say that this course that I took from Alan Truss was wonderful. I'll never forget it. I mean, it was just a pleasure to be in that class.
Now, you're a history major. Now, I majored in something much more practical, English literature. What did you plan to do with the history major when you started it?
You know, in those days, John, it really didn't make any difference. I mean, in those days, I just thought, well, okay, I'll get a job after I graduate from college, and we'll see what happens from there. But I just assumed I would get a job. I didn't think that I needed an economics degree, or I didn't think that I needed to be able to code software or anything like that. I just assumed that I'd be able to go right to Wall Street. And as it turned out, that worked out just fine. But, you know, I had the most unusual experience because there I was writing this paper about the Hukbalahap Rebellion and in the Philippines. And for a variety of crazy reasons, I ended up getting a job with Citibank right out of college in the Philippines. It was a summer internship. And I graduated on a Thursday, and I flew out to Manila. I was there on Sunday, and that was a really interesting time. But in answer to your question, it took me from that history major to practical experience in the Philippines with my degree. And so what I did is I ran around the city, and I talked to people. And I asked them what they were thinking. You know, how do you feel about the regime? Marcos was in power. How do you feel about the United States? I worked for a U.S. organization. And the questions that I asked, I was able to ask because of my history degree. So I never had any idea that they would be that my degree would be as valuable as it was. But I learned a lot about the culture and a lot about what the place was like before I set foot on the soil. And so it enabled me to run around the city of Manila and to kind of understand what some of the responses were. And so I can tell you that the last day I was in Manila working for Citibank, I gave a presentation to the country manager, and I said, look, we need to be careful here at Citibank because President Marcos is not popular. And because of that, we have to worry that about the American presence. I'm sort of... Let me put it in this context. Citibank at that time had this huge building that was designed by President Marcos's favorite architect. I may get this wrong, but my recollection is that his name was Louis Lacsin, and so here we were, this big powerful U.S. organization. Out in the Philippines, Marcos wasn't especially popular, and we were in a building that had been designed by his favorite architect. So what I said in my presentation is I said, you know, we need to be careful, security and everything. And I went home that day, and in fact, I was ready to spend, I think I actually spent a week afterwards in the country. But that was the end of my summer job. And later that day, I learned that a bomb had gone off in one of the bathrooms at Citibank. And fortunately, nobody was in there. Nobody was hurt. But it was, in fact, a terrorist event. And I just had no idea that my words would have been so prescient. And it all traces back to the work I did at Harvard College as a history major.
It's interesting. I'll take you back to your comments on deciding to be a history major and just assuming that after you had an education, you could go find a job. That was my experience, and I wound up as a technologist, first the government and then on Wall Street, for 40 years after that. But we assume that an educated person could do things, and the value of college was an education. And as a teacher now in colleges, it is so different. Students are expected from grammar school to focus in on what they're going to do, and to move toward it. When I went to college, the engineers and the accounting majors, they were really the only ones who really understood where their life would take them, and I see from talking to them and from my work that now jobs change every 2 years anyhow, as technology changes everything, and it's just very different, and it's more of a pressure on the young folks than I think was anything like what we had.
Well, you know something, you're absolutely right. I am a father now, and I've seen what my kids have gone through and how they have to be very focused from an early age. You know, times are changing. There's no question about it. And what I personally think, John, is that it's too bad that everybody has to be focused. And what I fear right now for this generation, for the millennials, is that they're going to have the mother of all midlife crises as a generation when they hit their 40s and 50s. Because if you're so focused from such an early age, I mean, how do you know that's going to see you through your whole life, right? I mean, I made a career change when I was 50. And I just wonder if you've always done one thing, you've played one sport, or you focused on one particular academic pursuit or something, whether or not you really understand what it is that you're truly passionate about. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that it's bad now. It's just different. And I worry about this the millennial generation when they get older.
Well, the most important thing that they have to learn is to adapt, because there are so many jobs that just change, or they go away, or they're replaced by algorithms and artificial intelligence or whatever, that they have to be able to always be learning. Now, many of our generation, they were able to always be learning and to change for the things, but many didn't have to. So that was different.
You know, you're right, and I just want to tell you a quick story. I don't mean to interrupt here, but I was lucky to get a job, and the job I had with Citibank was just a summer internship. I assumed that I would get a job, but I was without a doubt the worst interviewer in the history of mankind, or the worst interviewee in the history of mankind. I mean, if anything could go wrong during an interview, it would. And one of the things that happened to me when I was in college is I went down to this Office of Career Services, and I had an interview with Chase Manhattan. And I walked into the interview, and I was thinking how pretty this woman was, which is, you know, this is not the right thing to be thinking, but that's what was in my head, and it just tells you what I was like as a senior. And so I sat down, and she said to me, she said, "Look, Norm, I want to play situation conflict. I'm going to be a client, and you're going to be a banker, and at the end of the interview, you have to decide whether or not you'll make a loan to me." And so I said, well, you know, I know this right now. Do you want the money in tens or twenties? And I thought I was being charming. You know, I thought it was funny. And with that, she really clobbered me because she had just graduated from, I think, the London School of Economics and really knew her financial theory. And there I was, a history major, and anything I said was absolutely wrong. It was terrible. And so one thing after another, I said, you know, just terrible, terrible answers. And I knew I wouldn't get a job from Chase. And so when you have a really bad interview, what do? You grovel. And so at the end of the interview, she thanked me, and I was getting ready to leave. And there I was in this building, and I said, you know what, there's one thing you have to know, is I would really love to work for Chase Manhattan, and I'll tell you that if you hire me, you'll never have to worry about me coming to work on time, because I'll be the one turning the lights on in the morning and turning them off at night. And that's all I could say, because my answers had been so bad the previous 45 minutes or whatever. And so with that, I rose from my chair, I opened the door, and I walked through the door, and I closed it, and I realized I was standing in a closet in this in this room where I'd been interviewed. And you know, it was dark inside, and something hit my nose. And you know what it was? Is you remember those pull strings that would turn on a light? Well, It was the pull string to the light, and that's what was banging against my nose. And I'm thinking, oh boy, what do I do? I mean, for a moment, I thought that I would stay in the closet and just wait, just
until everyone
wait
home.
until everybody goes home. But I walked out, and I didn't see the woman. I was like, what happened to her? And I heard this. I don't know if I'm doing that well on the radio, but I this wheezing sound. And I realized, I looked on the other side of the desk, and I realized that she had fallen off her chair. She was laughing so hard. And I kind of peered down at her, and I said, and you know what? If you guys give me a job, I need a map, I need a blueprint of the floor plan. And with that, I was out of there, and I got a call back, and I ended up having a full-time job with Chase, which I kept for 4 years.
That was terrific. It's just, yeah, the well, so turn it off with your answers. I was also very lucky that I was in the right place at the right time through my life, through different opportunities. I got into technology on a quirk, and it was interesting. And then you went to grad school while you were at Chase?
No. Here's what happened. As you know, I had majored in history, but with this minor in Asian studies. And what I said to Chase after I got back from the Philippines, after I left Citibank, is I said, you know what? I would really like to go anywhere in Asia. I don't care where you send me. I don't care if you send me to one of the countries that's considered a hardship post. I'll go anywhere. And they liked that. And they said, why don't you go to Australia? And so Australia was part of the bank's Asian operations. And I said, sure, you know, fine. So I went to Australia. And here's the part that you'll get a kick out of. So prior to going to Australia, I think it was the end of 81. I may get my dates mixed up. But at the end of 81, there was a reunion at my high school at Exeter, and I met a woman by the name of Mary Graves, who is a classmate of mine. And I mean, I knew her, but we'd fallen out of touch. And we really hit it off at our fifth reunion. And so we had two dates, and I moved out to Australia with Chase Manhattan, and Mary joined me a few months later after the two dates. And we had the time of our lives in that country. It was fabulous. We made great friends. The work was challenging, and we ran around Australia, and it was a great adventure for us. I'd recommend that everybody goes overseas to the extent they can as soon as they get out of college or during college.
Did you find much? Everyone talks about that Australia tends to be one race, one religion, one culture. Did you find that as different from the United States?
Oh yeah, at that time, yes. There is no question, and I think it's very different now. We were back in. Let's see, 2009, and Australia is very different now. It's not one race, one religion. It's a multi-ethnic society now. So it's changed dramatically. And I think for the better. But look, every country can do a better job about being tolerant, about welcoming all people. And, Australia had a lot of distance to travel way back when in, I think, 1982 when I was out there. But you know what? So did the United States. Every country has a lot of room to travel. One thing I will say just as kind of an aside, it used to be that Melbourne, Australia, had the largest Greek population outside of Greece.
Really?
I don't know if that's still true. Yeah, but if you wanted to go to the city in the world that had the largest Greek population, I think you would go to Athens, and number two, you would go to Melbourne. There's a huge Greek community.
I show my students a picture every year when I'm talking about how to present things graphically, and it's a picture of Australia that has all of Europe, including the United Kingdom, within Australia. Just to talk about the size difference, you know, when you ask people, is Australia bigger than France? Oh yeah, well, is it bigger than France and Italy? Yes, and then you show them this picture, and it's amazing. One of the reasons I asked that question about the culture. There was a story, and it sounds too strange to be true, but I read it that when Murdoch originally bought the first time around the New York Post, that he brought some executives from Australia, and supposedly, and once again, this sounds too weird to be true. One of the fellows from Australia asked an editor, he said, I understand you're Jewish, where are your horns? And the editor said, oh, they're retractable. And he said, oh, okay. So, I don't know. That was just one of the weird stories that I heard. So.
Yeah, I can't tell you, at all comment on that. I just know that my experience with my friends, I didn't see I didn't say anything like that, every country can do better. That's
oh,
the
yeah.
bottom line.
Sure. And where'd you go after Australia?
So we left Mary, who's my wife, and I. She's my fiance then, but we left Australia in I think it was sometime around June of 1984. And the first thing that we did is we flew to Europe. And in Europe, we bicycled across the continent. We bicycled 1,500 miles over the course of this summer. and we had the time of our lives. I mean, what a great way to see the world bicycle. It was wonderful. And so we spent all that time bicycling. And we started in Copenhagen, and we bicycled in sort of a zigzag route to the Loire Valley in France. And I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation of the name. But it was really interesting. And along the way, we met a lot of people, and we had a lot of adventures. And, you know, the thing that I remember is we were somewhere in Belgium, I think. And Mary and I had finished bicycling for the day. We just arrived at the city, and we were walking along. We had our bicycles with us. We saw this couple coming from the opposite direction, and they were walking their bicycles. Now, in those days, we were in our early 20s, and the couple were, I would guess, in their 60s. It's been a long time. But let's say in their 60s, maybe even older. And the guy, he stopped us, and he said, "Oh, wow, you guys are bicycling. Do you like it?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, it's what fun." And he said, "Well, how many miles are you riding a day?" And I kind of puffed up, with pride. And I'm like strutting around feeling very macho and everything. "Well, you know, we're up to 75 miles and enjoying it." He said, "Yeah, we do about the same ourselves every day." And I was thinking, oh, boy, isn't that great? You know, I hope I can bicycle 75 miles when I'm in my 60s, 70s. And you know what? It's not that far away. So
my daughter spent 8 or 12 weeks before senior year in high school bicycling through Europe. It was a wonderful experience for her. I used to tell her that I used to go to Rockaway in New York, and instead she went to Europe to bicycle. But that's how things changed. So what did you do after you came from wherever to wherever from Europe?
Oh, right. I got off point. So that was just a summer experience. And afterwards, we both went through the MBA program at Harvard Business School. That was really interesting. It's a big change, John, I would have to say, because we had spent pretty close to 3 years in Australia, and just being back in the United States was culture shock.
And then what happened after the MBA program?
Let's see. So after the MBA program, we returned to Charleston and worked down there from 1986 to about 1993. That's right. And, it was great to be in Charleston, in large part because we were pretty close to my family. My family's really close. And so my mom and dad were there. And it was, I have to say, one of the great gifts of my life that I was able to be in Charleston for the last 2 years of my dad's life. He died in 1986. And see, I'd left to go away to school when I was 16. And I was in my late 20s and had been traveling a lot, had been away from home. And it was just great to be with my family. So we... in Charleston, Mary and I started our family, and we have two kids. Our son, Wynn, was born first, and then our daughter, Dana, but we call her Coco. She's just always been Coco. And the reason for that is, Charleston can be really, really hot. And late in Mary's pregnancy, It had gotten to be really steamy hot, and she was really suffering. And she put this picture of this Coco Chanel model up on the door of our closet in the bedroom, and she said, "You know what? That's what I'm going to look like after our daughter is born." And from that moment forward, our unborn daughter, we start referring to as Coco. So she's always been Coco, even though her real name is Dana.
I like that. And what took you out of Charleston then?
Well, frankly, business, for a variety of reasons. I had a really tough entrepreneurial experience, and Mary was working for a mail order company, and she was recruited to come up to Rhode Island, which is in part why we live here now. And she was recruited to run this mail order company, to run the marketing department of the mail order company. And the company's name is Ross Simons. And so they sold everything from jewelry to, I think, fine porcelain, if I'm not mistaken. But I may be wrong about that. What they were really known for and are still known for is jewelry. And they were based out of Rhode Island, and she was headhunted to come up here. And I was working through a couple of entrepreneurial ventures. And when we came up here, I decided, I need to get serious about my career. And so I joined Kidder Peabody as a financial advisor. And that's when I first got into the industry.
Yeah, and Kidder went away probably in the mid-90s, I remember.
Yeah, you know, I joined Kidder in part because I thought, all right, I need to work for a really solid organization, and I need some stability, and they're owned by GE Capital. Well, I was at Kidder no more than 6 months, and the organization blew up, because one of the traders had been playing around with the way he reported trades, and the firm had no idea. His name was Joe Jett. It was one of the big scandals of the early 90s. And when it surfaced how dependent the firm's profits were on his fraud, I mean, basically, GE just sold the organization. And that's too bad, because there were a number of really good financial advisors there. And I liked the company, but Payne Weber bought Kidder. Payne, and so I ended up working for Payne Weber, and for a variety of reasons that have to do with managing two careers, Mary and I moved to New York with her kids, and I went to work for Payne Weber for a couple of years in New York City. So it was the same organization. I just moved to New York.
I came across that kid explosion just a week ago. I'm doing some work at an old friend's firm, going through, they're moving to Austin. I've been going through archive going back to the late 1960s, and one of the fellows who works there, I knew from the previous experience with this company, had been with Kidder, and I found this advertisement from Kidder in the files, and I said, "Here, you might like this," and he blew up and started cursing about that trader who you mentioned. He said, "That son of a bitch ruined my career." You know, it still hurt some people. So you're with Payne Weber for a while in New York.
Yeah, for a couple of years, but really not that long, because I had an opportunity to go and work for Morgan Stanley in New York City. This was before they merged with Dean Witter. And that's when my career as a wealth advisor really took off. Look, I'm really critical about a lot of things that are occurred in the last few years on Wall Street. But I must say that I had a really great experience with Morgan Stanley as an organization. It changed my life for the better. I'm glad Wall Street is behind me, but I really enjoyed working there, and I learned a lot about managing money while I was there.
As I mentioned before we went on the air, my wife and I with Morgan Stanley, I was the director of data processing, responsible for system development and the like, and my wife was a system designer. And the interesting thing there, I had been with Dean Witter earlier. It was funny when they merged, they only had one alumni association. But Morgan, at Dean Witter, the computer people tended to work late or to work on the weekends on installation, and some of the arbitrage folks and all that did. At Morgan, everyone worked late. I was told when I joined the firm, you know, we pay well and we pay big bonuses and we expect people to work their asses off for them. And it was an interesting culture. It was a driven culture. We actually overpaid people and we stockpiled them because when, for instance, we bought the West Coast firm that was our first really retail business, Schumann Agnew. And we had people who had been cashiers at other firms who go out and run the operation for us. And we had the real depth, like the baseball team with a good utility infield who could go places. Where were you with Morgan?
I was in the area called private wealth management, and we were stockbrokers. Nobody calls stockbrokers anymore, but that's what we were. Now the term is financial advisor, and so I started really with a tiny business, and I joined a team of a couple of guys, and there were three of us all together, and we built a business up to, at our high point, I think we had $1.75 billion in assets under discretionary management. And, oh, by the way, discretionary means that we could buy and sell securities without asking our clients every time. They gave us permission, and so we operated like money managers. So we had about $1.75 billion in assets that we managed on a discretionary basis. And then we had another, I think our total assets in-house were around $10 billion or so at our high point. Because we have lots of concentrated blocks in things like dot-com stocks or optical networking stocks or other industries that were going through meteoric growth.
When did you turn to fiction writing? If you hadn't done any of this in your background, and in 2007, you mentioned you turned your first novel in that was published in 2009. What moved you in that direction?
You know, I guess it had something to do with the fact that I probably enjoy the people of Wall Street as much as I enjoy the markets, the capital markets themselves. There are a lot of characters on Wall Street. They have crazy stories, John. And so late during my time at Morgan Stanley, I started writing my first novel, Top Producer. And I would get up at 5 in the morning, I'd write until 7, I'd go to the office, and I'd work until, I think, 6:30 or so. And I'd be at home in time to have dinner with the kids and Marion. And then after we had family time together, I'd write in the evenings. And my wife called me a hermit with a laptop. But I think what it is you know, there are just a lot of great stories about people. And I told some stories to one of my classmates from college during one of our reunions. And she said, you know, you need to write a book. And she was a published author herself. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And I used to hear it every once in a while when I talked to clients about some of the things that would go on in the industry. And they'd say, oh, you need to write a book. And so I did. And in Top Producer, one of the stories that it tells is basically a true story. I've fictionalized it a little bit, but it's true. And excuse me, I'm having a sip of water. But the story is about a friend of mine. And he's somebody I met earlier in my career. And he had a good-sized business relative to mine at that point. And he used to work really hard. And he had this one client this one firm that was a client of his. And there were two or three guys with the firm. And they invested a lot of money with him via the firm. It was the firm's money. And so the firm was based out in the Midwest. And they'd fly into the East Coast, and they would meet my colleague, and they would disappear into the conference room for, let's say, all day during their quarterly trips to review portfolios. And behind closed doors in the conference room, they would talk about their portfolios all day long. And, you know, that's a long day. There's so much you can do. You talk about the market, you talk about this position. And I know that one time at the end of the day, the client said, you know what, we're done. Let's go out and get some dinner. And my colleague says, absolutely. So they went to some steakhouse, and they had this big meal, and it was a great meal. And afterwards, he was ready to go home. He had four daughters, and he wanted to get home and see his wife, you know, and he's ready to go. And the client said, uh-uh, we've come all the way from the Midwest. We're going out drinking. And they wanted to go to a strip bar. Now, bear in mind, this is a family-rated story, so nobody has to disconnect here. And the other point I would make is nobody in financial services really wants to go to the strip bar because you get in trouble and somebody sees you and you don't want to be recognized and you can't expense anything either, right? I mean, you just can't. Nobody wants to go. But the clients were insistent that they go out to the strip bar. So the clients and my colleague went to the strip bar. And they walked in, and my colleague just wanted to hide. He didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be recognized. But you know what? The clients pulled him up to the walk, and there was this woman who was dancing on stage, and she had her hands over her head, nothing on but a smile. And she took a look at these men, and she screamed something in some foreign language. It was like bloody murder, and she ran off the stage, and from nowhere, three bouncers in the strip club came and surrounded my colleague and his clients, and they pulled them outside, and this one bouncer who had a nose that went in like three different directions, you know, he cocked his arm and he was ready to punch out my colleague, and he said, now, what did you say to that girl? What did you say? My colleague said, she's my nanny. and he had no idea that she was dancing. And so, you know, that's one of the stories that I heard. And I thought, those are stories that belong in a book someplace. And, you know, I've got enough stories like that to write for the next 50 years, but that's one that ended up in Top Producer. And so now, I like those stories, and I decided to write them.
Now, the Top Producer got very good reviews. Would you tell us about the book?
Well, here's how the book starts. There's this black tie party at the New England Aquarium in Boston. There are 500 guests. It is a huge surprise birthday party for this 30-something-year-old woman. She's not 30. I think it's her 32nd birthday. It's not a special party. And her husband is this very prosperous money manager. And he surprised her, and he just wanted to throw this party. So the party is going nuts, and everybody is loving it and dancing. There's a big band there. And about halfway through the party, or toward the end of the party, I should say, this money manager disappears, and nobody knows where he is. But, you know, people party on. And then there's a screen, and everybody looks at the giant ocean tank in the New England Aquarium. There's 200,000 gallons of seawater, and they see the money manager. And he's not in front of the giant ocean tank. He's in the middle of the giant ocean tank. And there's this stainless steel trolley cart that is pulling him down, down, down. And the water's been chummed, and three sharks eat him in front of 500 guests. And that's how it starts. And the birthday girl is now a widow, and she calls a guy, a friend of hers. His name is Grover Rourke. He's a recurring hero in my fiction. And she says, "Grove, I have a problem. I don't know where our money is. Do you manage it?" And that's what kicks off the action.
And then, so it carries through. Now, it's considered a thriller, so I assume there's some intrigue as we go along.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's where's her money and what was going on that her husband was eaten by three sharks in front of 500 people, because there's a story there. And yeah, there is a thriller there.
And then,
so
go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, just as an aside, you might get a kick out of this story. So Top Producer was my first book, and interestingly, it was published in Australia 2 weeks before it was released in the United States. And my publisher out there, this wonderful organization called Murdoch Books, flew me out, and I went to the Brisbane Writers Festival to help launch the book in Australia. And one of the things that it might be interesting to you is that being an investment advisor on Wall Street in some ways was absolutely the worst experience in the world for becoming a writer. And the reason I say that is, on Wall Street, if you talk to anybody from the press, you get fired. You're gone. I mean, there's no second chances. Get out of here. Goodbye. And when I wrote this book, I never really thought about dealing with the press. And I was really afraid to talk to the press. I was afraid of the media. And you know what? If you're a writer, you have to talk to everybody in the press and the media. You want coverage. Otherwise, your books, nobody will know about your books. And so in Australia, when I was in the process of launching the book out there, I was at the Brisbane Writers Festival, as I mentioned before, which is a lot of fun. And so the first day of the festival, I think that I talked to two or three different radio stations. I know I was on one TV show, and I talked to a couple of newspapers, and I thought, wow, you know, what's a big deal? I like these guys in the press. This is fun. They don't have horns. I mean, this is great. And so I kind of got a big hit. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm famous. At one book, and I've arrived. I'm a household name. And part of that was that night I actually had an interview at 2 in the morning with the Buddy Cianci show in Rhode Island. Now, remember, there's this huge time difference. So 2 in the morning in Australia is like, I don't know, noon in Rhode Island. And, you know, I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. So my wife and I had this great day. We talked to the media and running around. It was just good fun. And we had been visiting all of our friends from 30 or so years earlier. And that night, I just knew I would sleep through the radio interview. And so what I did is I set an alarm at 1 o'clock in the morning Australian time so that I had an hour to wake up and get ready to be lively on the show at 2 in the morning. And so, you know, I set every alarm inside. I had the reception area called me from the front desk. And by the time all these alarms went off and got all the phone calls and all these beeps and buzzes, it sounded like there was a 5-alarm fire in the neighborhood. So I got up, and I was a mess. You know, I had bedhead. I had on these PJs from last century, literally. So I threw on some shorts, but I left on my pajama tops. And I went downstairs with a BlackBerry, and I sat in front of the hotel outside the building on this park bench, and I was drilling into my BlackBerry, answering emails at 1 in the morning, just trying to wake up. And at that point, excuse me, I saw this woman coming back from what had been obviously a big night out Australian style. So she's walking in my direction. She has these two guys in tow. I'm just there on the bench trying to mind my own business. And she points at me. I thought, oh. And she points at me again. And I thought, again. And she grabs these guys, and they start walking toward me. And they're coming closer and closer. And by the time I think maybe she might have been, 5 feet away, I thought she was going to ask me for my autograph. And she said, she pointed at me and she says, oh, look, he's homeless. And I was crushed. I mean, she thought I was homeless there sitting on the bench. And I looked behind me and, you know, there's nobody behind me. Sure enough, she's talking about me. And she was relentless. John, she just relentless. She said, do you think he needs money? And, these delusions of fame and notoriety just crushed. I mean, my ego was in the puddle next to the fire hydrant. And so I suspect when she said that, that I looked like a deer in the headlights. And I was shaking my head no. And I think my hands, and remember, I'm holding my smartphone. I think they started to rise involuntarily as I was looking at her and shaking my head. And the woman said, oh, look, it's okay. He has a BlackBerry. And, you know, that was my first experience being a recognized author. So that was kind of fun.
But then you got to do the interview anyhow, right? So,
Yeah, 2 o'clock. I called in the radio show, and it was great fun. Yep.
And then 2 years after that, you followed up with the Gods of Greenwich. Were you still working on Wall Street, or did you go into full-time writing?
No, I was. So I left Wall Street in 2009. a top producer came out in September of 2009. The Gods of Greenwich came out in 2011, and The Trust the following year. So, yes, I left Wall Street.
Tell us about the Gods of Greenwich.
You know, that was a fun book to write. And part of the reason was The Gods of Greenwich is about the hedge fund industry. And it's really about this product called life settlements. And life settlements are, you know, it's a scary way to say life insurance, but companies can actually buy life insurance, and they can buy life insurance they can buy policies from the owners, they pay the owners, and then they have a vested interest in the life of whoever is insured. And the way this business originated is really because of AIDS, sadly. There were a lot of AIDS patients, and they needed money, and they would sell policies on themselves that had been in force for a long time. They needed money for hospice or whatever. And I think that business was called the Viaticals business. But it morphed, it changed over time, and it became what was called life settlements. People would sell policies on themselves that they didn't need for some reason or another. I think Larry King, for example, sold a life insurance policy that had been taken out on him, and you know, his estate didn't need the death benefit. So essentially, in The Gods of Greenwich, I said, okay, let's say you have a company that starts buying these life settlements, and hedge funds are always under pressure to deliver numbers, performance. And so the premise of this is simply that let's say the company starts taking matters into its own hands and whacks people early so that they get the life insurance payouts early. That's what that book's about.
And
it's a take on the old game that the Westies were playing around in the early 20s, I think. They would go out and they would find some drunk and get him or her life insured. They'd take out life insurance on the person and they'd whack him a few days later. And this was just an updated version of that game.
Mickey Featherston. Mickey Featherston and the Westies. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm aware of them.
You know, the thing that I liked doing, though, at the time is what I really wanted to do was to take a look at what the culture was like. What does it mean to be in the hedge fund industry, feel like, to keep up with the Joneses? You know, back in, I'm trying to think of what the exact numbers were, but around the time that the Gods of Greenwich came out, there was a number, and basically the 25 highest paid hedge fund managers in the world, in aggregate, all right, in aggregate, the top 25, they made something like, I think it was $21 billion in what essentially is W-2 income. It was personal income. And at the time, I think General Electric's profits were somewhere around $11 billion. All right, so you think about that. I mean, you have 25 guys making that kind of money. That's crazy. And then you have this huge blue-chip company of 300,000 people, or I don't know how many people work for GE anymore, but a lot of people working for the organization, and they generate 11 billion, half of what those 25 guys made. And I thought it would be really interesting to explore the lifestyles of the people in the industry, and so that's what I wrote in that book. And basically the way I researched it is I would go to Greenwich and I would sit at a bar, and I would go on Wednesday and Thursday nights around 11 o'clock when everybody was going home, usually on a Wednesday, on Thursday, people stay later. But I'd talk to the bartenders around 11 o'clock on Wednesday nights, and you hear some really good stories from those guys. And that's kind of what worked its way into the Gods of Greenwich.
Now, of course, there's much more focus and there's much more press coverage on income inequality and who makes so much in comparison to the GDP of Greece or of Portugal, for instance. Then the very next year, you published The Trust, and that was actually somewhat predictive of actual events that happened not long thereafter. Tell us about them, and did you have any prior knowledge of the possible events?
No. So the Trust is really a story about money laundering, okay? And here's the thing. In the United States, it's really hard to prosecute religious organizations. Okay, it just is. If you go after, Catholics, if you go after Jews, if you go after Baptists, if you go after Jains, anything that's religious, it's really hard because of this freedom of religion. So the Trust is about some bad guys, and they start laundering money. And they do it through an organization called the Catholic Fund. And the Catholic Fund is totally fictional, and it's totally fictional. And I'm trying to make sure that it is the name of the organization is the Catholic Fund, but it's my imagination. It's not based on anything real. But the idea is the bad guys were laundering money through this organization that called itself the Catholic Fund. And so what the Catholic Fund does in the book is they own a piece of this sex superstore. And they own this business, this sex superstore, because it's cash business, and there's money flowing in and out. It's cash, and those cash businesses are really interesting to guys who want to launder money. And so I, in a million years, never thought that any component of this would come true. I mean, because think about that. That's really out there. You know, some organization, a Catholic organization, owning investment I'm drawing a blank here, John. In a porn store. I mean, bottom line. And it was just the sex superstore. I mean, that's out there. But what occurred about 9 months later, I would say, is there was an article in a newspaper about this priest in Connecticut. And he had broken bad, and he was cooking meth, and he was laundering his money because he had purchased an interest in a sex store in a strip mall in Connecticut. And this was the real deal. I had no idea. And it was just unbelievably eerie to me that something which I thought was really outlandish ended up coming true. And because of that experience, what I feel now is that if an author can cook it up, no matter how outrageous, maybe it's happening out there. And that was my takeaway.
Sure. We've seen that in science fiction being so predictive. Speaking of money laundering, and this takes us back to the real world. My old bank that I used to have an account with, HSBC, if you remember, within the last 2 years, they paid billions of dollars of the fines to the federal government here because they had been accused and they've settled of money laundering for drug dealers and for organized crime, and no one went to jail. If this was you or I money laundering, we'd be doing 20 years in the slammer. Obviously, someone had to prove these deals, and it was my feeling that they should have gone to jail. Did you follow those stories, and do you have any particular comment on it, on them?
Yeah, it's really wrong. It's wrong, bottom line. There are certainly two standards out there. I know the story that you're speaking about, and I have no idea who's responsible for what at HSBC. That's one example of many. You can talk about what government watchdogs have done when it comes to regulating financial services companies. You can also speak about the Department of Justice, whether or not they're fairly prosecuting these organizations. And any way you come out of it, I mean, it just looks like the justice has been really uneven, and it's not right. It's just not right at all.
On your website, you refer to yourself as the most trusted name in financial malfeasance. Does this indicate that your fiction writing will continue to fall into the genre of financial thrillers?
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. When I get up every morning, what makes me tick is rooting out any bad guy or helping people save themselves from financial predators. And I think you can do that through both fiction and nonfiction. So I'm working on a nonfiction book right now called The Dirty Little Secrets of Money. And in all of my novels in the past, I've always tried to talk about some vehicle that is available to readers that they can use to protect themselves from financial predators. Let me give you a good example of one of these vehicles. In one of my novels, I mentioned this organization called BrokerCheck. So if your listeners Google BrokerCheck, they'll go to a site which is sponsored by FINRA, which is one of the industry watchdogs. They watch over financial services companies. And online, they keep this basically an employment record of active and frankly inactive people who have been stockbrokers, who have been registered investment advisors, registered through FINRA with a Series 7, 63, 65, and a bunch of the others. And BrokerCheck is a great way for people to go out and check their financial advisors. So I've talked about BrokerCheck in my fiction, and I'm going to talk about it in my nonfiction. And the best story I can tell you about the value a broker check is something that happened to me. So about 3 days before I went out on book tour for the Gods of Greenwich, I got a call from a really close friend of mine. He says, Norb, would you take a look at this investment for me? And you know something, it came at a really tough time for me because I was trying to sort the details for my book tour. But the friend who called me is a really good friend, and I said, of course, you know, how can I help? And so he described the investment, and the guy pitching him was his neighbor, as well as a retired U.S. ambassador. And what I've learned personally, John, is that you always, whenever you invest in anything, you always start with the people. Forget about the investments. Really, the people that count. If you can't get past the people, you shouldn't invest your money in the deal, whatever it is. And so I said to my buddy, I said, well, just send me the information that you have. And he did. And I found out that his neighbor had graduated from Harvard College a few years before me. So I said, check, you know. Great, he didn't go to Yale. I like that about him. And then I saw that he ran a broker-dealer, which meant that he was licensed, and the neighbor would be on broker check. So I looked at the neighbor on broker check. I found him within 30 seconds, and I found out that he had been kicked out of the financial securities industry for 2 years, about 15 years ago, because he had forged a colleague's name to get a loan. Okay, he had been, after he was discovered, this forgery was discovered, he was kicked, or he was fired from the firm, and as I said, he was kicked out of the industry for a couple of years. So, you know something, we know that at one point in the neighbor's life, he was under financial duress, which is probably why he was trying to get that loan. And he did absolutely the wrong thing. So I called my buddy back, and I said, there's no way you could invest in that deal. And he didn't, and I thought that was the end of the story. But here's what happened. About 15 months later, I got an email from my friend, and the subject said, we owe you huge. And I opened up the email, Norb, if you and Mary go out to dinner, it's on us. We don't care where you go. If you go to Paris, it's on us. We'll pay. Hit us for a big bottle of wine. And I thought, wow, what's going on here? And he said, click on the link below. And so I clicked on the link below, and I discovered that his neighbor had been hauled off by the FBI, that the neighbor had been charged with embezzling his church. He had been charged with a $750,000 fraud from his church, that he had schemed other investors with a Ponzi scheme. And, you know, I felt terrible for the folks who had lost money, but I can tell you that in my entire career giving financial advice, I'd never felt better about the financial advice than I felt about what I told to my friend. Because my friend had wanted to invest six figures in his neighbor's deal, and he didn't. And I saved him from the fraud. And, you know, it was a good moment in my life. And I'm telling you this story now, John, because that site, that broker check, should be where every investor starts. But you know what? Only 15% of all investors use it, according to the guy who's at the top of FINRA right now.
And broker check, T-E-C-H?
Broker check, like stock broker, but just broker check, C-H-E-C-K.
Oh,
and
C-H-E-C-K.
It's all one word, just...
I got it.
One word, Google it. And the guy from Harvard, the neighbor that was pitching the deal, he's now in prison. He's spending 17 years there. He's serving out his sentence.
Wow. One of the hilarious and rather chilling pieces on the website, speaking of this, is Tales from the Dark Side of Prospecting. Tell us about some of those stories, if you remember them.
Oh, sure. So what I do now, in addition to writing fiction and nonfiction, is I also write a column for the Wealth Advisor section of the Wall Street Journal. And this column is where I speak principally to financial advisors, and I kind of get to mouth off. I say whatever I think, and hopefully I strike a chord with financial advisors because, you know, I remember what it was like when I couldn't talk to the press and I'd get fired for speaking my mind. So I say whatever I think. I'm not tied up to any organization anymore. And as a consequence of writing this column, I end up talking to a lot of people in financial services, and I hear great stories. And so I was talking to this one fellow, and he said that 20 years ago or so, when he broke in to wealth management, he was just starting out as a financial advisor. One of his colleagues told him about this prospecting technique that he had. And so the colleague had this cat, and he would, and the cat had this tag on its collar. And the tag said, "If you find me, call this number." So this broker, this stockbroker, would take this cat out to some affluent neighborhood. Let's say Greenwich. Let's say Beverly Hills 90210. Let's say, you know, some very affluent neighborhood somewhere, you know, outside of Chicago, wherever. It was. I think that the broker was actually in New York, but I'm trying to convey a sense of how he was targeting wealthy neighborhoods. But the broker would take this cat, and he'd drive out to this wealthy neighborhood. He would just drop off the cat. He would turn the cat loose. And so the cat would wander around, and invariably some good Samaritan with deep pockets would find the cat, would call the number, they'd reach the broker at his office, and he'd say, "Oh, my goodness, I'm so relieved. Oh, I've been worried sick about my cat." And then he would start talking to that person, that Samaritan, who found his cat, and he would try to get accounts out of that, which is, I mean, it's funny, but it's also disgusting. I mean, anytime you meet somebody under false pretenses, it's not the way to do business. But I told the story in that column for the Wall Street Journal as just part of a larger thoughts on the industry.
On your site, you mentioned a talk to be giving in Providence, Rhode Island on May 2nd. Tell us about that.
Well, you know what? I'm really excited about that. I'm giving a TED talk, a TEDx talk in Providence on Saturday, May 2nd. And I'm just so flattered to be included in the cast of people who are speaking. There's someone from the Federal Reserve up in Boston who's speaking. Ann Hood is speaking, a best-selling New York Times author, and it should be a lot of fun. My topic is, how do you know you can trust somebody with your money? And, that's a question that I'll be trying to answer, and I have a lot of thoughts on it. But, you know, three classic mistakes that people make. They trust their gut. Bad idea. It's a good way to go broke, trusting your gut when it comes to your money. Another mistake people make when they look for financial advisors is they take references from the advisors. I mean, come on, you know? It's like You know, you're only going to hear glowing things about the advisor because he or she is only going to give you the names of people that are in the bag that will say great things about the advisor. So that's a mistake. You know, another one is hiring people who work for blue chip organizations only because they work for blue chip organizations. Just because somebody works for a great company doesn't mean he or she wears a halo. So I'll be trying to answer this question in my TEDx talk. The question being, how do you know you can trust somebody with your money?
That's good. Then it'll be up on the net forever. We've had a very good conversation. What else would you like our audience to know about Norv Vonnegut?
You know something, I'm just delighted to have been on the air with you. And if there's one thing people can do in the audience, I would love them to go to my website, norvvonnegut.com, and to click on the tab that says The Trust Project, and to answer the question, how do you know you can trust somebody with your money? You know, I'm tweeting that question to celebrities every day. I'm tweeting that question to politicians. I just want to hear what people have to say to see whether or not somebody has really good insights. And, you know, my particular take on this is when it comes to investing, nobody loves your money more than you do, so you have to be careful. You have to take responsibility for taking care of it. But I always want to hear answers to the question on that page. So go to norvvonnegut.com and click on the tab that says Project Trust.
Well, folks, thank you very much, Norv. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, so much fun. Love your show, John. And, thanks for having me on.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in Western Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. The Western Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westernguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. And in the words the Met radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, URLs for previous shows and the schedules of upcoming shows. Tune in next week for my conversation with Otto Penzia. And until then, as he's saying, the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver, steady, steady, Silver. Ha, 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 ha